She's very upset with me because she believes things I did that I did not do. And the other part is, I mean, but despite my multiple attempts at reaching out to her, she did not contact me back. I even left her a message one time that, you know, I'm your supervisor. I have your back. You do need to call me. We do need to work this through. And she did not speak to me then as well. And then my colleague pointed out that there had been a meeting, you know, before that and prior to that, threatening anyone that if anyone made contact with me, it would jeopardize their job and that I am a dangerous human being. So my two thoughts are maybe she was afraid, maybe she collaborated with this because she may have been angry because of everything she was told that I did with there is no evidence and I did not do it. And I can only speculate. I'm not a mind reader, you know.
If I may address that issue for just one moment.
Absolutely.
If you look in the materials, you'll see that Dr. Wiley raises these concerns to the extent she had them at all about 5 days after the CEO of this company terminates the contractual relationship with Dr. Z. And she is responding. If you look at the email she writes, it's almost as if he is soliciting from her a list of complaints that she might have. She says, "Hello, Faisal. Below is a list of concerns that I feel may not have been appropriate psychology supervision practice, as we mentioned." You know, it just begs the question when you've got this very contentious underlying civil action going on, and the board really doesn't know much about that or what's going on, but I will represent to you that is an extraordinarily contentious contractual dispute. And it's all initiating right here 5 days later when Dr. Wiley, apparently writes solicited comments to the person who is essentially terminated a contractual relationship with Dr. Z. So I just think it's important to look with a jaundiced eye at some of this information. Mm-hmm. And the motivations behind what people might be alleging, because that's all we have are allegations. We don't really have any kind of clear and convincing or even, you know, more likely than not proof on the issue.
Yeah, Mr. Auger and Dr. Z, I do understand that. I'm going to just, it probably goes without saying, and it sounds as though Dr. Z probably recognizes it now in hindsight, that we equally don't have any documentation to prove the contrary, which is where it's so important that supervision documentation and the times that you're meeting with the supervisees and you're talking to them about ethical concerns, or you're talking to them about specific competencies, that's clearly documented, because it's very difficult to prove just from a calendar that the meetings occurred or didn't occur. And so, like I said, I think that it seems as though to me that Dr. Z has recognized the need to change some of those practices to ensure that is aligned with supervisory standards. And Dr. Gill, probably, I'm a behavior analyst and not a psychologist, so our supervision standards do definitely differ. But as a supervisor, I'm a big proponent in our line of work to make sure that documentation every single time you meet with the supervisee is sound, so that we don't have that question, so that we would be able to rebut that with, no, here is what really happened. And so I appreciate the perspective, but again, wanted to just reiterate the importance of that documentation. And that's all the questions that I had.
I thoroughly agree. I mean, documentation is like, documentation and billing is now a core of everything I do to the best. And I'm reaching out to different people and different resources that I didn't really realize were available for me out there to get better answers than colleagues who may not be up to standard of what is necessary. So I have really learned that.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions from the board members? All right, hearing none, this is the time where the board goes into deliberations amongst ourselves without any interruptions from any of the other people participating in this meeting. As the lead, I'll start the discussion. I recognize that there were billing errors. I do feel that the doctor, based on the information they provided, did did due diligence and notified the insurance companies of the error. She actually certified those letters. And I think that showed a lot of due diligence after she realized that there were billing errors. I do have concerns about the supervision. There's no contract, there's no documentation. This is a person working under her license, and there's nothing that shows what the discussions were or what occurred. And obviously there were some potential issues that the supervisee had maybe conducted in her activities. So my bigger concerns is a lack of supervision and documentation, and even a contract that lays out what the agreements were between the two. Thoughts from my other committee members.
Well, I would certainly agree. I think the biggest issue I think is the supervision issue and the lack of documentation. And of course, as I'm sure Dr. Z realizes now, that the documentation is in part meant to protect us, psychotherapists and supervisors, and when a question comes up, you can refer back to the documentation and address the issue because you have something to back up, your verbal claim. And a lack of documentation, is part and parcel of the implication here that Dr. Wiley and perhaps others were not properly monitored. And so they were kind of on their own. And as I had stated earlier, I think the therapy that Dr. Wiley was performing was complex in that she was seeing multiple family members and oftentimes it may be advised to refer some of those people out rather than to see virtually every available family member for treatment. After a while, you don't know where your allegiances lie and it becomes very confusing, and lacking a plan for how to address family members. It's my speculation that harm results as a result of not having a proper plan, not having a proper focus of treatment, and not having that properly documented, and not having that clear and informed consent as to where this treatment is going, and for the patients to be very clear about where the treatment is focused on and what the goals are. So, yeah, and of course, there is issue with billing and record keeping. Those are concerns that I have as well. And the NPI issue is, although I guess it's the argument was no harm, no foul regarding the use of an NPI number. Nevertheless, it's simply not appropriate for an intern to bill. And unfortunately, in this case, the supervisor is responsible for what the supervisee does in terms of their billing, regardless of Vibrant's role or not. So I'll let it go at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Dr. Davis-Wilson.
I agree. I think that the changes that have been put into place appear to be positive ones, but it is the documentation is still concerning. Because we don't have, like I said, proof of one way or the other of what occurred with supervision and what did not. And unfortunately, in this particular case, there was, at least a supervisee that kind of went rogue and was operating on their own accord without supervision. So I do want to note and take into consideration, because I do think that it's important to acknowledge the changes that the doctor has put into place, and to recognize, these are very, very difficult circumstances. And unfortunately, sometimes it does take, going through a circumstance like this to really take a look back at your practice and decide, hey, there's a lot of things I need to change. And And it appears that the doctor has done that. And I appreciate the honesty and kind of the humbling responses that have been provided, and that there hasn't been a lot of argument or attempts to mask the issues, but rather a acknowledgement of the issues and acknowledgement of change that is necessary moving forward.
Thank you. If there's a looking at if potential violations, it would, in my opinion, be 32-2061-8-16-H, failing or refusing to maintain or retain adequate business, financial, professional records pertaining to the psychological services provided to a client or patient. Is there one specifically for supervision?
Well, there's an ethical standard.
Is that, and I was trying to find that, is, do you know?
Well, it's 7.06. Assessing supervision, supervisee's performance.
Assessing student and supervisee's performance. You're right. There it is. I think that is the crux of the issue. In regards to the billing, I mean, definitely there. I think Dr. Gill, you noted it. You shouldn't be using someone else's identification number. But it appears as though that was recognized. When the error was recognized, she did due diligence. She did send out certified letters. She did acknowledge the issue. Wasn't like trying to hide it, and let's deal with it. So I think it was a mistake that was taken care of. My concern is more or less the supervision. Unless, does someone just think that the billing issue would move forward? Comments, thoughts?
Madam Chair, for me, I think one of the challenges with the billing issue is that when you are practicing, and I agree, it is still your responsibility, but when you're practicing under a practice that has, you know, their own separate administrative teams handling some of those things, sometimes it's difficult to have full control over all of the billing. And so I think recognizing, whoa, there has been an error, and rectifying that error is something that I've seen happen in many cases. I think the concern is, at what point was the error recognized and pointed out? But it sounds like the doctor has put in some procedures to check in more frequently to ensure that that there is more frequent conversations with the billing department. But I think it's very difficult when you're in another practice and that practice has a specific billing procedure or process or people operating it. And I do agree. And I also, you know, preach to my fellow colleagues and supervisees that regardless of who's actually doing the billing, at the end of the day, it's your responsibility to catch it. But I think it's not unusual for the errors to go out and then be rectified at a later time once they've been identified.
I think the issue would have been if it's not rectified, that's the issue. If you knew about it, you're not rectifying it. In this situation, I think that there was due diligence. My concern would be the supervision. So I would recommend, you know, this move forward to the board with a potential violation of ARS 32-2061-16. DD, violation of the ethical standards, 7.06, assessing student and supervisor performance.
Madam Chairman, there's also rules regarding supervision.
That was the, okay.
Let's start R426-209 and 210 that you may want to reference in general. And if you do think that there could be an issue with billing, this is just a recommendation to the board about your possible concerns. And so if you think that there might be an issue with the billing, you could notice that, and it will then be up for discussion by the board.
Notice it meaning identify a violation, or just notice it in a comment?
You could notice of a potential violation or at least a concern. And then that way the doctor will be notified that it could be discussed, and the board may have additional questions about billing.
All right. I would be in agreement to just notice that we acknowledge that there was a billing issue, but also that it was rectified, and we can discuss that then more at the board meeting. Ms. Galvin, could you tell me that, I'm sorry, the rule again, I got him in front of me. I was trying to find that. 32.
R4, 26, 209, and 210 discuss supervision.
R4, 24 or 26?
26.
209. Oh, general supervision.
Okay. And 210.
And 210. I would reference that then too, because I think you're right. That's where it specifically talks about what should occur. So I would add those two to a potential violation. So R4-26-209 and R4-26-210. As regards, and also the DD
7.06.
Thank you. So that is my motion.
Should there all be, how about the issue of informed consent?
There was, they signed the document that stated that there would be a psychologist or psychologist intern. And I think the concern we had was there wasn't an acknowledgement of a potential intern, and that is on that that is on that one form, which both clients signed. Do you think, Dr. Gill? I mean, what is your opinion on?
My concern is particularly 10.02, informed consent regarding the treatment of families. And I don't think that there was informed consent regarding treatment of RJ and his partners or fiancés or ex-spouses or his son. I don't think there was a clear informed consent regarding the treatment of the family members. So I would include 10.02 as a an ethical standard that would apply here.
All right, thank you. I would agree. I think you're right on regards to the family issue. Any other thoughts? So in regards to the ethical violation 10.02, that's the therapy involving couples and families, 7.06, which is the assessing student and supervisory performances, and then the two rules that were mentioned, and then
one other, the documentation
and
issue.
And then H, right.
Okay, that's H, I'm sorry, okay.
That's H, right. So just to be clear, 32, ARS 3220-61, 16, H, and then DD, which would be 7.06, which is supervisory, 10.02, which is the couple and family, and then R4-26-209, general supervision, and 210, supervised professional experience.
209 is probably the more appropriate.
Okay, then just 209. Thank you. So that is my motion. Is there a second?
I second.
Is there any discussion? Hearing that, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. I just want to let both parties know that our board staff will be contacting you in regards to the procedure moving forward. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, it's now 10:45. Would you like to take a 5-minute comfort break?
Sure. Yes.
Okay, let's just take in 10 minutes. So let's say at 10:50, let's all regroup. So go ahead and put your phone on mute, and we'll get back about 10:50.
Hi, my name is Jean Galvin, and my son, Grant LaFleur, is a patient of Dr. Matsumoto's. And I have read her most recent COVID-19 marathon update, but I would like to make an appointment with her to discuss my son's journey to school because he's special needs.
Jean, we can hear you. Jean?
4:45. Okay, thank you.
Jean.
Okay, thank you very much. 10-5-2000. 4:45.
Jean?
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Jean?
Yes.
Hi, this is Charlie Hover. I heard your phone call. I think we all did.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, I think we're just waiting for others. Dr. Gill. All right, I think we're all back. Dr. Gill, Dr. Davis-Wilson, me, Ms. Galvin, Ms. Michelson. All right. Welcome back to the CSC meeting. We're back in order. The time is 10:53. Our next complaint is agenda item 4D on complaint number 1615 regarding Dr. Stephen Gray. Dr. Gill, you're the lead. Would you like to provide a summary of the case?
Yes, I would. This is regarding Stephen Gray. And on April the 21st, 2016, there was an anonymous complaint that Dr. Gray was exploiting students, allowing students to facilitate sexual offenders groups and provide treatment without appropriate training and supervision. And there are also, quote, unnecessary delays, unquote, in services to mandated patients under probation. At the time of the complaint, Dr. Gray's practice entitled Psychological and Consultative Services Agency provided clinical and forensic psychological services and specialized in the assessment and treatment of sex offenders and victims of sexual abuse. The agency training site included treatment by postdoctoral students and interns, and provided a number of centers in, I assume, the greatest Phoenix area. And the students were trained at various stages of training and licensure. The agency website was accessed by staff both in 2016 and in 2020. Now, in July of 2016, the complaint screening committee reviewed the complaint and it was tabled. It was moved on to the next month and reviewed again in August of 2016. Dr. Gray filed a complaint bringing up the an issue of jurisdiction for the board and complained about violating his constitutional rights of due process and equal protection under the law. Now, he brought this issue to court, and the court dismissed in August the 1st of 2017, dismissed Dr. Gray's complaint as a final judgment. In September of 2017, Dr. Gray's attorney appealed the ruling. In February of 2018, court dismissed Dr. Gray's appeal due to lack of jurisdiction and denied his request to treat the appeal as a special action. Dr. Gray filed for a motion of summary judgment in Superior Court, and the court ruled against him. In April of 2019, Dr. Gray submitted a notice of appeal with the Court of Appeals. In March of 2019, requested the board to settle the matter, and the settlement decree was that the board would agree to dismiss the complaint in exchange for Dr. Gray not pursuing further appeal. It's also indicated that Dr. Gray has not operated the agency in 3 years. He still works there, but does not supervise students. Now, in April of 2019, the meeting settlement by the board, namely the complaint screening committee, rejected Dr. Gray's offer of settlement. In March of 2020, the Court of Appeals reaffirmed the Superior Court's decision to dismiss the case, and the court matter was resolved, and the complaint was back before the complaint screening committee. The complaint itself indeed was somebody that's anonymous, and I already indicated the issues of complaint. The focus of attention of the treatment was to provide treatment to such populations as high-risk offenders, seriously mental ill offenders, both low and high-functioning, and female offenders. Dr. Gray sometimes was not present at the agency or available to students to provide supervisory services and has contributed delayed services as well. The licensee response was that Dr. Gray in May of 2016 acknowledges that the complaint that he received was responded to in a timely manner. Dr. Gray objects to the complaints for the reasons already given. Dr. Gray denies any unethical practices and such as exploiting students. He made it clear in his response that the agency procedure in place to ensure that services are properly rendered, students carefully screened, evaluated, appropriately watched, and to see if they were appropriate to work directly with sex offenders, running groups and the like. And the new students would shadow existing students for at least a day. Formal training begins with Dr. Parnell or other supervisory, another supervisory psychologist that may include Dr. Gray. Training includes a review of assessments, oversight of programs, treatment modalities, office procedures, and expected treatment outcomes. Also, there is training occurs at various venues as reported, such as the Arizona State Hospital. And Dr. Gray indicated that during the first 3 months, he works with students on a weekly basis, or did at that time, work with students on a weekly basis using a workbook. And they use many examples and approaches that are appropriate and reviews multiple offender responses. Students trained in dynamics of sexual offending, types of sexual offending, including paraphiliac behaviors. Student observes more than one group session. Psychological facilitation, again, on a weekly basis. After 1 or 2 months of group observation, students asked to take notes regarding groups run by a facilitating psychologist. Once student masters documentation, students begin to present offender assignments from the workbook and the like. When supervising psychologist deems the student proficient, students may facilitate groups and without the supervising psychologist being present. Dr. Gray provides weekly supervision of students and makes self available. That's a statement. And if feedback is needed, he was available even on the weekends and on holidays. Students required to write quarterly reports reviewed by Dr. Gray or another supervisor. Dr. Gray supervises former students, provides feedback, including those on probation. The students never left on site without a supervisor present on the premises. Students train and supervise when dealing with high-risk offenders, SMI, sex offenders, and female offenders. Dr. Gray reiterated, students never at risk. A psychologist is always available in the office to provide supervision and intervention. Workbooks are included in training as indicated. Agents' relapse rates below the national average. No specific incidents are cited by the complainant, so it's difficult, according to Dr. Gray, to respond to the allegations. Of course, these allegations did occur in 2016. That's the end of my commentary. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Dr. Gray, you're present? I can't hear you. Are you on mute? I can't hear you. On the lower left-hand side, you see a little microphone. It should, if there's a line through it, it's on mute.
How's that? How's that?
Now I can hear you.
It shows that he's...
Whoa, I got the phone going too.
Oh, okay, yeah, turn off the phone then. All right. Can you hear me?
Dr. Gray, can you please unmute your computer audio on the lower left?
On the lower left, you see the microphone? It should not have a line through it. It says mute. If you move your little, the arrow down, your little, there you go.
Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you now.
Okay, thank you.
All right, great. Thank you for being here today. We do appreciate it.
Do we have Mr. Hober on the line as well, who's representing him? Mr. Hober, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, thank you.
I didn't realize you had representation. Thank you both for being here today. Do one of you like to make an opening comment?
This is Charlie Hober. I'll just make a real quick comment here, and then Dr. Gray is available to answer questions. Thank you, Dr. Gill. That was a comprehensive review of the progress and procedures of the case. Just wanted to point out that in May of 2016, soon after the complaint was filed, Dr. Gray did his best to answer the fairly general allegations from the anonymous complainer. Because of that, there was no real context to put the specific complaint in to see if there was a limited opportunity to review or to try to understand or explain where the complaint came from. So what you've got is a Dr. Gray's description of his practices in response to the general allegations of some problematic practices. That came timely and at the time that the complaint was made, so the passage of time has not affected the actual recitation of the facts that Dr. Gray was able to put forth soon after the complaint came out, and so you do have a full description in that letter of his practices at the time. Dr. Gray is now semi-retired and has not been supervising or running the facility for a number of years. With that, Dr. Gray is available to answer your questions, and I thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Dr. Gray?
So, yes, I have one brief question. I just be curious to hear from Dr. Gray his response to the allegations from Anonymous about the allegations of poor training, exploiting students, and unnecessary delays and inappropriate supervision. Do you have a brief comment about that, sir?
Well, I enclosed a pretty comprehensive response, my own personal one, and then one, you know, characterized by the attorney. I've been supervising students for Argosy. Am I still there? Because it's got a
green
telephone. and so I started in 1999, working with Argosy, Dr. Wechsler, and Andy Hoag, and all those people, and went to all the meetings for a while about how to supervise, developed a strategy. We've had numbers of students come through here. Some of them are doing really well. Some are published. Some are, one's a clinical director of a ACTCPC here. And so I developed a strategy that I thought worked well. First, we screened people. You know, they would show up, and mostly it was me and Dr. Pondell, and because other people had other work to do, but we would interview people and see if it was a good fit, because sometimes I think they kind of got, I don't know if harassed is the right word, but pushed into an agency where they didn't want to be. Like, I had one lady, she said, I went over her record with her, and she, everything had to do with child psychology. And I said, I don't see any frenzy goals in your system. And she said, well, they kind of asked me to be here. And so, you know, I told her I didn't think this was the right fit. But then the next step is, after that meeting, then they shadow usually another student for at least a day. And of course they can decline that, but most oftentimes they do it. Then the next step is I teach the manual. It's a not workbook anymore. It's what we call it, a manual, and it's a very good manual. written by Bob Emmerich, and then me and my wife wrote a study guide to it and then integrated it, and then I paid Bob so I could use it because it's really, really a good workbook. Anyway, the next step is that's about, I don't know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, go through it. The next step is that I just said sit in group and watch. I don't want you to do anything except watch. The next step is I ask them to keep notes because that's not my, I don't like doing it that much. And then the next thing is I'll ask them to do assignments. There's 20 or so or 30 assignments in the workbook. And then after they do some assignments, it seems to do well. And because in our groups, every person is invited to give feedback to the person that's presenting in group. And I think the other thing to realize is that all of these people are on probation. The notion that these people are high risk is very strange because there is very few high risk offenders that are on probation. There are some, but it's a very minimal number. The high risk people are in the sexual violent predator program over at ACTCPC, which I've done about 30 trials plus SCP stuff, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. And then the next step is they would run groups by themselves, and I would be, my office is like 12 steps away from the group room, and I would sit in on occasion. I wanted them to get the feel of what it's like to run themselves. Some of them, you know, had never run groups, and it was great to watch the process of being really scared and all that to like being really competent and, you know, take charge and that sort of thing. I also met with them at least once a week. And then of course they changed that to twice a week. But the other thing that I like to do that I thought was really different and the students would tell me they appreciated is the idea that we would work cases, you know, we would have a client that it was difficult and we'd sit and talk about it. And the other thing too is if there were difficult clients in the group that were, you know, being assertive or aggressive or not, you know, in line with what we're doing, I would pull them out of group. They would stay in group sometimes, but I'd pull them out and do individual with them for as long as it took to get them back to group ready, because some guys are just not group ready. So, and then put them back in group because they have to finish group in order to get considered for probation termination. The issue, so I think that's a very, very good program. One lady told me, she said, I'm really happy to be here. And I said, well, what's up? And she said, the last place she went to, they gave her the key and told her where the group room was. And that was the training. So I thought, well, that's better. With regard to the issue of scheduling, the front office did that, although they work for me, so I'm responsible for them. But offenders often would want financial aid. And so they would file a petition with probation to get financial aid. And then sometimes that took some time, and they absolutely prohibited us from seeing them without a voucher from probation saying they'd get started. And sometimes that took some time, and sometimes we'd have to call up and gently suggest to probation that they get going. And then some of the guys, frankly, would be manipulative, to be honest with you. They would call it like 6 o'clock after hours and then tell the probation officer that, well, no one answered the phone and they didn't call me back. That's, you know, not true. Cause I have this phone that I was just on cause I couldn't figure out how to get into Zoom. I finally figured it out, sort of an IQ test, I guess. I give them my phone number. I hand out my phone number to all the offenders. They can call me anytime they want to. And some of them do and most of them don't. Same thing with the people that I'm supervising. And mostly I've gotten good feedback from everybody. I'm concerned that, you know, if this was such a travesty and of justice and all that, that someone didn't call me up and say, hey, Dr. Gray or hey, Steve or whatever, and say, you know what, this is really inappropriate. Why don't you do something about it? This is the first time I ever heard about this is this. And so I'm kind of mixed about that because, you know, it's partly on me that people didn't feel like or want to approach me about it. But I think it's also on them to not approach me and say, hey, I think this is a mess or a problem. So that's, it's just what I just told you, sort of a summary of what's already been published and presented. I apologize to the board. It wasn't personal against you people. I just think accepting anonymous complaints is just not appropriate. I will tell you, I've done evaluations of over 100 doctors, physicians, nurses, chiropractors who have been accused of sexual misconduct, and it's all anonymous, and they put in there, do not tell them who they are, and every one of them knows who it is. So the idea of being anonymous is really doesn't work if people think it works. And the other thing too is that when I got this complaint, I don't know when they're talking about, I've been supervising students for 20 years, is what year are we talking about? 2005, four, I don't know. And so that was concerned about lack of specificity. So I hope the board will dismiss this thing and then I can kind of move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gray. I appreciate it. That's all the questions that I have.
All right, thank you. Dr. Davis-Wilson, do you have any questions?
I do not.
All right. I don't have any follow-up questions. Dr. Gill, any further questions for Dr.
I'd like to make a motion. Oh. I'd like to make a motion to dismiss this case.
We get a motion. Is there a second?
I would second that.
We got a motion. Is there any discussion?
Well, I think Dr. Gray makes a good point about the problems of anonymity. And in addition, yes, the person that was anonymous first had a duty to speak up on their own behalf. And there was a lack of specificity in the complaints, and I appreciate Dr. Gray's difficulty in having to respond to this. And I can also appreciate his concerns about the constitutional issues involved. And frankly, there just wasn't enough meat in the bone here to consider whether there's an ethical or legal violation. There just wasn't much there. And so that's why I made the motion that I did.
I will just want to make a comment in regards to the anonymous. Anonymous complaints are allowed, and they are taken seriously by this board, especially when I'm chair. And that's part of our responsibility as a regulatory agency. We accept it. You accept the anonymous complaint with the information that's provided. And so you have to look at the information. And in this particular case, I would agree with you, Dr. Gill, that it's somewhat not detailed. We don't have a lot of meat to the bone, as you said. But I would, being an anonymous complaint, I think, especially since I represent the general public, I think it's viable in regards to our regulatory overview, it is allowed. And so I would want to make sure, I just want to just kind of reiterate that we do allow anonymous complaints. And we would support them. Like with any complaint, whether it's anonymous or not, we look at what is in the complaint and do we have enough data or information. And I think I would agree with you, Dr. Gill, on this one. I think it's a little bit broad and there's not enough to see a violation. So I believe we have a motion and a second, correct? All right, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. All right, Doctor, thank you for thank you for joining us today. We do appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, I'm gonna move to complaint number 2042, Dr. Carlson. Dr. Davis-Wilson, you're the lead. Would you like to provide a brief summary?
Yes, Madam Chair. In 2019, TriWest authorized DC to participate in individual psychotherapy sessions with Dr. Carlson for 6 months. Dr. Carlson did provide 8 individual sessions from August of 2019 to October of 2019, but DC elected not to finish treatment.
On March 16th, the board received a complaint from DC that alleged that Dr. Carlson was asked to send an entire treatment record, of which Dr. Carlson sent copies of handwritten notes that were difficult to read due to poor handwriting. DC called Dr. Carlson back and requested that he send all typed notes, including all of the notes that he sent to TriWest. Dr. Carlson told DC that there were no typed notes and that TriWest does not require any notes for billing. And DC represents that HIPAA laws require professionals to give the patients their medical records, which he felt Dr. Carlson has refused to give. Dr. Carlson did respond to the complaint in a timely fashion. It is his understanding that DC is under the impression that Dr. Carlson is withholding typed notes that were not, or that were furnished to TriWest. However, Dr. Carlson maintains that he has included all of his documentation in DC's case, which includes notes and several items that were provided by Dr. Carlson, or to Dr. Carlson by TriWest and DC. Dr. Carlson provides a summary regarding the treatment, stating that he did see DC for 8 one-hour sessions to provide EMDR treatment. And that he does still concur with the mental status reports that were provided to him by TriWest. He did on August 14th of 2019 do an intake session in which he obtained a history of DC and reviewed all of the documentation provided by DC, and then proceeded with completing the first phase of EMDR and then 4 EMDR sessions. In accordance with DC's verbal statements and Dr. Carlson's personal assessments during the treatment, Dr. Carlson concluded that the treatment was not sufficient of benefit to warrant continuing. However, he left it open at the last session on October 30th, 2019, as to whether or not DC would return to future sessions pending his own judgment of whether he thought the treatment was helpful or not. Dr. Carlson responded to the complaint allegations, stating that, as he noted, in the weeks following DC's session, he received a call from DC who requested medical records. He agreed to send DC the contents of the file, although it did consist entirely of, mostly entirely of handwritten progress notes. Shortly after receiving the material, DC called Dr. Carlson complaining that he could not read the notes and demanded that Dr. Carlson send him the typed reports that were provided to the VA or TriWest on his behalf. Dr. Carlson explained that he did not have any typed notes and that TriWest never requested any reports other than the handwritten notes for the first session to document that DC had begun treatment. DC was surprised that Dr. Carlson had not furnished reports to TriWest, but seemed to accept the statement. That conversation ended without further discussion. However, DC contacted Dr. Carlson several months later and requested the typed reports again. Dr. Carlson explained that he had no such reports and that Dr. Carlson had sent him the entire contents of his file. DC accused Dr. Carlson of having told him previously that he had sent TriWest reports to the case. He also stated that Dr. Carlson had called his father and told him that he had sent the report to the VA. DC's father had not been mentioned in any previous conversation, so Dr. Carlson was not aware of where those, was not understanding the references to his father. And denied having told DC that a report was sent to TriWest. It's Dr. Carlson's position that he complied with DC's request and sent him the entire contents of the file, with the exception of the materials that DC had actually provided to Dr. Carlson. DC is demanding something Dr. Carlson cannot provide him, which is a typed report that Dr. Carlson never prepared, nor did he send to TriWest. Dr. Carlson believes that he acted professional in this manner and that he provided DC with everything that he's asked for. He does state that his record keeping for this case does not depart from usual practices in working with clients referred by any source, and that his handwritten progress notes have always been sufficient for him to personally refer back to and recall important details, diagnoses, etc. He will prepare reports via Microsoft Word if contracted to do so, but does not prepare them unless they are specifically requested or clearly in the patient's best interest. And it is relevant that Dr. Carlson has not received a complaint in 20 years of practice, nor has he been criticized for providing handwritten notes when asked to document treatment, whether by insurers, attorneys, or clients. And that concludes my summary.
Thank you, Dr. Davis-Wilson.
DC, are you with us today, the complainant?